and Leisha loved each as if it were her own. She'd been honored to tears when they named their youngest after her. "Good morning, rascals," Leisha said, squatting down and letting Mary's children fall into her arms. She hugged them tightly and kissed them, slipping them pieces of candy wrapped in paper before rising. She made the candy herself, another thing she had learned from Bruna. "Good morning, Leisha," Mary said, dipping a small curtsy. Leisha bit back a frown. She and Mary had stayed close over the years, but Mary looked at her differently now that she wore the pocketed apron. And nothing seemed able to change that. The curtsy seemed ingrained. Still, Leisha treasured their friendship. Sarah came secretly to Bruna's hut, begging palm tea, but their relationship ended there. To hear the women in town tell it, Sarah kept well enough entertained. Half the men in the village supposedly knocked on her door at one time or another. And she always had more money than the sewing she and her mother took in could bring. Brienne was even worse in some ways. She hadn't spoken to Leisha in the last 7 years, but had a bad word to say about her to everyone else. She had taken to seeing Darcy for her cures, and her dalliances with Evan had quickly given her a round belly. When Tante Michelle had challenged her, she had named Evan the father rather than face the town alone. Evan had married Brienne with her father's pitchfork at his back, and her brothers to either side, and had committed himself to making her and their son Callan miserable ever since. Brienne had proven a fit mother and wife, but she never lost the weight she'd put on during her pregnancy, and Leisha knew personally how Evan's eyes and hands wandered. Gossip had him knocking frequently on Sarah's door. "Good morning, Mary," she said. "Have you met Messenger Marrick?" Leisha turned to introduce the man, only to find he was no longer at her back. "Oh, no," she said, seeing him facing off with Garrett across the market. At 15, Garrett had been bigger than any man in the village save his father. Now at 22, he was gigantic. Close to 7 feet of packed muscle, hardened by long days of the axe. It was said he must have Milanese blood, for no Angerian had ever been so large. Word of his lie had spread throughout the village, and since then the girls had kept their distance, afraid to be alone with him. Perhaps that was why he still coveted Leisha. Perhaps he would have done so regardless, but Garrod hadn't learned the lessons of the past. His ego had grown with his muscles, and now he was the bully everyone had known he would be. The boys who used to tease him now jumped at his every word. And if he was cruel to them, he was a terror to any unwise enough to cast their eyes upon Leisha. Garrod waited for her still, acting as if Leisha were going to come to her senses one day and realize she belonged with him. Any attempts to convince him otherwise had been met with wood-headed stubbornness. "You're not local," she heard Garrod say, poking Marrick hard in the shoulder. "So maybe you haven't heard that Leisha's spoken for." He loomed over the messenger like a grown man over a young boy. But Marrick didn't flinch or move at Garrod's poke. He stood stark still, his wolf eyes never leaving Garrod's. Leisha prayed he had the sense not to engage. "Not according to her," Marrick replied, and Leisha's hopes fell. She started moving toward them, but already a crowd was forming around the men, denying her a clear path. She wished she had Bruna's stick to help her clear the way.
"Did she say words of promise to you, messenger?" Garrod demanded. "She did to me."
"So I've heard," Marrick replied.
"I've also heard you're the only fool in the Hollow who thinks those words mean a Corling's piss after you betrayed her."
Garrod roared and grabbed at the messenger, but Marrick was quicker, stepping smoothly to the side and snapping up his spear, thrusting the butt right between the woodcutter's eyes. He whipped the spear around in a smooth motion, striking behind Garrod's knees as he staggered backward, dropping him hard on his back. Marrick planted his spear back on the ground, standing over Garrod, his wolf eyes coldly confident. I could have used the point, he advised. You would do well to remember that. Leisha speaks for herself. Everyone in the crowd was gawking, but Leisha continued her desperate push forward, knowing Garrod and knowing that it wasn't over. Stop this idiocy, she called. Marek glanced at her, and Garrod used that moment to grab the end of his spear. The messenger's attention snapped back, and he gripped the shaft with both hands to pull the spear free. It was the last thing he should have done. Garrod had a wood demon's strength, and even with him lying prone, none could match it. His corded arms flexed, and Marek found himself flying through the air. Garrod rose and snapped the 6-foot spear in half like a twig. "Let's see how you fight when you're not hiding behind a spear," he said, dropping the pieces to the dirt. "Garrod, no!" Leisha screamed, pushing past the last of the onlookers and grabbing his arm. He shoved her aside, never taking his eyes off Marek. The simple move sent her reeling back into the crowd, where she crashed into Doug and Nicholas, going down in a tangle of bodies. "Stop!" she cried helplessly, struggling to find her feet.
"No other man'll have you," Garrod said. "You'll have me, or you'll end up shriveled and alone like Bruna."
He stalked toward Marek, who was only just getting his legs under him. Garrod swung a meaty fist at the messenger, but again Marek was quicker. He ducked the blow smoothly, landing 2 quick punches to Garrod's body before retreating well ahead of Garrod's wild return swing. But if Garrod even felt the blows, he showed no sign. They repeated the exchange, this time with Marek punching Garrod full in the nose. Blood spurted, and Garrod laughed, spitting it from his mouth.
"That your best?" he asked.
Marek growled and shot forward, landing a flurry of punches. Garrod couldn't keep up and hardly tried, gritting his teeth and weathering the barrage, his face red with rage. After a few moments, Marek withdrew, standing in a cat-like fighting stance, his fists up and ready. His knuckles were skinned, and he was breathing hard. Garrod seemed little the worse for wear. For the first time, there was fear in Marek's wolf eyes.
"That all you have?" Garrod asked, stalking forward again.
The messenger came at him again, but this time he wasn't so quick. He struck once, twice, and then Garrod's thick fingers found purchase on his shoulder, gripping hard. The messenger tried to pull back out of reach, but he was held fast. Garrod drove his fist into the messenger's stomach, and the wind exploded out of him. He struck again, this time to the head, and Marek hit the ground like a sack of potatoes.
"Not so smug now, are you?" Garrod roared.
Marek rose to his hands and knees, struggling to rise, but Garrod kicked him hard in the stomach, flipping him over onto his back. Leisha was darting forward by then, as Garrod knelt atop Marek, landing heavy blows.
"Leisha is mine," he roared, "and any what says otherwise will..."
His words were cut short as Leisha threw a full fist of Bruna's blinding powder in his face. His mouth was already open, and he inhaled reflexively, screaming as it burned into his eyes and throat, his sinuses seizing and his skin feeling as if burned with boiling water. He fell off Marek, rolling on the ground, choking and clawing at his face. Leisha knew she had used too much of the powder. A pinch would stop most men in their tracks, but a full fist could kill, causing people to choke on their own phlegm. She scowled and shoved past the gawkers, snatching a bucket of water Stephanie had been using to wash potatoes. She dumped it over Garrod, and his convulsions eased. He would be blind for hours more, but she wouldn't have his death on her hands. "Our vows are broken," she told him. "Now and forever. I will never be your wife, even if it means dying shriveled and alone. I'd as soon marry a Corling." Garrod groaned, showing no sign he'd heard. She moved over to Marek, kneeling and helping him to sit up. She took a clean cloth and daubed at the blood on his face. Already he was starting to swell and bruise.
I guess we showed him, eh? The messenger asked, chuckling weakly and wincing at the pain it brought to his face. Alicia poured some of the harsh alcohol Smit brewed in his basement onto the cloth.
Ah!
Marek gasped as she touched him with it. Serves you right, Alicia said. You could have walked away from that fight, and you should have, whether you could have won or not. I didn't need your protection, and I'm no more likely to give my affection to a man who thinks picking a fight is going to gain the favor of an herb-gatherer than I am the town bully.
Well, he was the one that started it, Marek protested.
I'm disappointed in you, Master Marek, Alicia said. I thought messengers came smarter than that. Marek dropped his eyes. Take him to his room at Smit's, she said to some nearby men, and they moved quickly to obey. Most folks in Cutter's Hollow did these days. If you're out of bed before tomorrow morning, Alicia told the messenger, I'll hear of it and be even more cross with you. Marek smiled weakly as the men helped him away.
That was amazing, Mary gasped when Alicia returned for her basket of herbs.
It was nothing but stupidity that needed stopping, Alicia snapped.
Nothing? Mary asked. Two men locked together like bulls, and all you had to do to stop them was throw a handful of herbs.
Hurting with herbs is easy, Alicia said, surprised to find Bruna's words on her lips. It's healing with them that's hard. It was well past high sun by the time Alicia finished her rounds and made it back to Bruna's hut. How are the children? Bruna asked as Alicia set her basket down. Alicia smiled. Everyone in Cutter's Hollow was a child in Bruna's eyes. Well enough, she said, coming to sit on the low stool by Bruna's chair so the ancient herb-gatherer could see her clearly. Jan Gray's joints still ache, but his mind is as young as ever. I gave him fresh sweet salve. Smit remains abed, but his cough is lessening. I think the worst is past. She went on, describing her rounds, while the crone nodded silently. Bruna would stop her if she had a comment. She seldom did any more.
Is that all? Bruna asked.
What of the excitement young Keek tells me went on in the market this morning?
Idiocy is more like it, Alicia said. Bruna dismissed her with a wave.
Boys will be boys, she said, even when they're men. It sounds like you dealt with it well enough.
Bruna, they could have killed each other, Alicia said.
Oh, pfaw, Bruna said. You're not the first pretty girl to have men fight over her. You may not believe it, but when I was your age, a few bones were broken on my account as well.
You were never my age, Alicia teased. Jan Gray says they called you hag when he was first learning to walk.
Bruna cackled. So they did, so they did, she said.
But there was a time before then when my paps were as full and smooth as yours, and men fought like corlings to suckle them.
Alicia looked hard at Bruna, trying to peel back the years and see the woman she had been. But it was a hopeless task. Even with all the exaggerations and tampweed tales taken into account, Bruna was a century old at least. She would never say for sure, answering simply, I quit counting at 100 whenever pressed. In any event, Alicia said, Marek may be a bit swollen in the face, but he'll have no reason not to be on the road tomorrow.
That's well, Bruna said.
So you have a cure for Mistress Giselle's young charge? Alicia asked.
What would you tell her to do with the boy? Bruna replied.
I'm sure I don't know, Alicia said.
Are you? Bruna asked. I'm not. Come now, what would you tell Giselle if you were me? Don't pretend that you haven't thought about it.
Alicia took a deep breath. The Grimroot likely interacted poorly with the boy's system, she said. He needs to be taken off it, and the boils will need to be lanced and drained. Of course, that still leaves his original illness. The fever and nausea could just be a chill, but the dilated eyes and vomit hint at more.
I would try monk leaf with lady's brooch and ground adder bark, titrated carefully over a week at least.
Bruna looked at her a long time, then nodded.
Pack your things and say your goodbyes, she said. You'll bring that advice to Giselle, personally.
Chapter 14 The Road to Angiers 326 AR Every afternoon, without fail, Ernie came up the path to Bruna's hut. The hollow had six warders, each with an apprentice, but Ernie didn't trust his daughter's safety to anyone else. The little papermaker was the best warder in Cutter's Hollow, and everyone knew it. Often he brought gifts his messengers had secured from far-off places, books and herbs and hand-sewn lace. But gifts weren't why Leisha looked forward to his visits. She slept better behind her father's strong wards, and seeing him happy these last 7 years was greater than any gift. Ilona still caused him grief, of course, but not on the scale she once had. But today, as Leisha watched the sun cross the sky, she found herself dreading her father's visit. This was going to hurt him deeply. And her as well. Ernie was a well of support and love that she drew upon whenever things grew too hard for her. What would she do in Angiers without him? Without Bruna? Would any there see past her pocketed apron? But whatever her fears about loneliness in Angiers, they paled against her greatest fear. That once she tasted the wider world, she would never want to return to Cutter's Hollow. It wasn't until she saw her father coming up the path that Leisha realized she'd been crying. She dried her eyes and put on her best smile for him, smoothing her skirts nervously. Leisha, her father called, holding out his arms. She fell into them gratefully, knowing that this might be the last time they played out this little ritual. Is everything all right? Ernie asked. I heard there was some trouble at the market. There were few secrets in a place as small as Cutter's Hollow. It's fine, she said. I took care of it. You take care of everyone in Cutter's Hollow, Leisha, Ernie said, squeezing her tightly. I don't know what we'd do without you. Leisha began to weep. Now, now, none of that, Ernie said, catching a tear off her cheek on his index finger and flicking it away. Dry your eyes and head on inside. I'll check the wards and we can talk about what's bothering you over a bowl of your delicious stew. Leisha smiled. Mum still burning the food? She asked. When it's not still moving, Ernie agreed. Leisha laughed, letting her father check the wards while she laid the table. I'm going to Angiers, Leisha said when the bowls were cleared, to study under one of Bruna's old apprentices. Ernie was quiet a long time. I see, he said at last. When? As soon as Marek leaves, Leisha said. Tomorrow. Ernie shook his head. No daughter of mine is spending a week on the open road alone with a messenger, he said. I'll hire a caravan. It will be safer. I'll be careful of the demons, Da, Leisha said. It's not just Corlings I'm worried about, Ernie said pointedly. I can handle Messenger Marek, Leisha assured him. Keeping a man off you in the dark of night isn't the same as stopping a brawl in the market, Ernie said. You can't leave a messenger blind if you ever hope to make it off the road alive. Just a few weeks, I beg. Leisha shook her head. There's a child I'm needed to treat immediately. Then I'll go with you, Ernie said. You'll do no such thing, Ernol, Bruna cut in. Leisha needs to do this on her own. Ernie looked at the old woman, and they locked stares and wills. But there was no will in Cutter's Hollow stronger than Bruna's, and Ernie soon looked away. Leisha walked her father out soon after. He didn't want to go, nor did she want him to leave, but the sky was filled with color, and already he would have to trot to make it home safely. "How long will you be gone?" Ernie asked, gripping the porch rail tightly and looking off in the direction of Angier's.
Leisha shrugged.
"That will depend on how much Mistress Giselle has to teach, and how much the apprentice she's sending here, Vika, has to learn. A couple of years, at least."
"I suppose if Bruna can do without you that long, I can too," Ernie said.
"Promise me you'll check her wards while I'm gone," Leisha said, touching his arm.
"Of course," Ernie said, turning to embrace her.
"I love you, Da," she said.
"And I you, Poppet," Ernie said, crushing her in his arms. "I'll see you in the morning," he promised before heading down the darkening road.
"Your father makes a fair point," Bruna said when Leisha came back inside.
"Oh?" Leisha asked.
"Messengers are men like any other," Bruna warned.
"That I have no doubt," Leisha said, remembering the fight in the marketplace.
"Young Master Marek may be all charm and smiles now," Bruna said. "But once you're on the road, he'll have his way, no matter what your wishes, and when you reach the forest fortress, herb gatherer or no, few will take the word of a young girl over that of a messenger."
Leisha shook her head.
"He'll have what I give him," she said, "and nothing more."
Bruna's eyes narrowed, but she grunted, satisfied that Leisha was wise to the danger.
There was a sharp rap at the door just after first light. Leisha answered, finding her mother standing there, though Ilona hadn't come to the hut since being expelled at the end of Bruna's broom. Her face was a thunderhead as she pushed right past Leisha. On the sunny side of 40, Ilona might still have been the most beautiful woman in the village, if not for her daughter. But being autumn, Alicia's summer hadn't humbled her. She might bow to Ernie with gritted teeth, but she carried herself like a duchess to all others.
"Not enough you steal my daughter, you have to send her far away?" she demanded.
"Good morn to you as well, mother," Alicia said, closing the door.
"You stay out of this," Ilona snapped. "The witch has twisted your mind."
Bruna cackled into her porridge. Leisha interposed herself between the two, just as Bruna was pushing her half-finished bowl away and wiping her sleeve across her mouth to retort.
"Finish your breakfast," Leisha ordered, pushing the bowl back in front of her and turning back to Ilona. "I'm going because I want to, mother. And when I return, I'll bring healing the likes of which Cutter's Hollow hasn't seen since Bruna was young."
"And how long will it take this time?" Ilona demanded. "You've already wasted your best breeding years with your nose buried in dusty old books." "My best..."
Leisha stuttered.
"Mother, I'm barely 20. "Exactly," Ilona shouted. "You should have 3 children by now, like your friend the Scarecrow. Instead, I watch as you pull babes from every womb in the village but your own."
"At least she was wise enough not to shrivel hers with palm tea," Bruna muttered.
Leisha whirled on her.
"I told you to finish your porridge," she said,
and Bruna's eyes widened. She looked ready to retort, then grunted and turned her attention back to her bowl.
"I'm not a brood mare, mother," Leisha said. "There's more in life for me than that."
"What more?" Ilona pressed.
"What could be more important?"
"I don't know," Leisha said honestly. "But I'll know when I find it.
And in the meantime, you leave the care of Cutter's Hollow to a girl you've never met, and Ham Hand Darcy, who nearly killed Andy and half a dozen since?"
"It's only for a few years," Leisha said. "My whole life you called me useless, but now I'm supposed to believe the Hollow can't get on a few years without me?"
"What if something happens to you?" Ilona demanded. "What if you're caught on the road? What would I do?"
"What would you do?" Leisha asked.
"For 7 years you've barely said a word to me, apart from pressing me to forgive Garrod. You don't know anything about me anymore, mother. You haven't bothered. So don't pretend now that my death would be some great loss to you. If you want Garrod's child on your knee so badly, you'll have to bear it yourself."
Ilona's eyes widened, and as when Leisha was a willful child, her response was swift.
"I forbid it!" she shouted, her open hand flying at Leisha's face.
But Leisha wasn't a child anymore. She was of a size with her mother, faster and stronger. She caught Ilona's wrist and held it fast.
"The days when your word carried weight with me are long past, mother," Leisha said.
Ilona tried to pull away, but Leisha held on a bit, if only to show she could. When she was finally released, Ilona rubbed her wrist and looked scornfully at her daughter.
"You'll be back one day, Leisha," she swore. "Mark my words, and it will be much worse for you then."
"I think it's time you left, mother," Leisha said, opening the door just as Marek was raising his hand to knock. Ilona snarled and pushed past him, stomping down the path.
"Apologies if I'm intruding," Marek said.
"I came for Mistress Bruna's response. I'm bound for Angiers by mid-morning." Leisha looked at Marek. His jaw was bruised, but his thick tan hid it well, and the herbs she had applied to his split lip and eye had kept the swelling down.
"You seem well recovered," she said.
"Quick healers go far in my line of work," Marek said.
"Well, then fetch your horse," Leisha said, "and return in an hour. I'll deliver Bruna's response personally."
Marek smiled widely.
"It's good that you go," Bruna said when they were alone at last. "Cutter's Hollow holds no more challenges for you, and you're far too young to stagnate."
"If you think that wasn't a challenge," Leisha said, "then you weren't paying attention."
"A challenge, perhaps," Bruna said, "but the outcome was never in doubt. You've grown too strong for the likes of Ilona."
"Strong," she thought. "Is that what I've become?"
It didn't feel that way most of the time, but it was true. None of the inhabitants of Cutter's Hollow frightened her anymore. Leisha gathered her bags, small and seemingly inadequate. A few dresses and books, some money, her herb pouch, a bedroll, and food. She left her pretties, the gifts her father had given her, and other possessions near to her heart. Messengers traveled light, and Marek wouldn't take well to having his horse overburdened. Bruna had said Giselle would provide for her during her training, but still, it seemed precious little to start a new life with. A new life. For all the stress of the idea, it brought excitement as well. Leisha had read every book in Bruna's collection, but Giselle had a great many more, and the other herb gatherers in Angiers, if they could be persuaded to share, held more still. But as the hour drew to a close, Leisha felt as if the breath were being squeezed from her. Where was her father? Would he not see her off?
"It's nearly time," Bruna said.
Leisha looked up and realized her eyes were wet.
"We'd best say our goodbyes," Bruna said. "The odds are we'll never have another chance."
"Bruna, what are you saying?" Leisha asked.
"Don't play the fool with me, girl," Bruna said. "You know what I mean. I've lived my share twice over, but I'm not going to last forever."
"Bruna," Leisha said, "I don't have to go."
"Fah," Bruna said with a wave of her hand. "You've mastered all I can teach you, girl. So let these years be my last gift to you. Go," she prodded. "See and learn as much as you can."
She held out her arms and Leisha fell into them.
"Just promise me that you'll look after my children when I'm gone. They can be stupid and willful, but there's good in them when the night is dark."
"I will," Leisha promised. "And I'll make you proud."
"You could never do otherwise," the old woman said.
Leisha sobbed into Bruna's rough shawl.
"I'm scared, Bruna," she said.
"You'd be a fool not to be," Bruna said.
But I've seen a good piece of the world myself, and I've never seen a thing you couldn't handle.
Marek led his horse up the path not long after. The messenger had a fresh spear in his hand, and his warded shield slung over the horn of his saddle. If the pummeling he had taken the day before pained him in any way, he gave no sign. "Aye, Alicia," he called when he saw her. "Ready to begin your adventure?" Adventure. The word cut past sadness and fear, sending a thrill through her. Marek took Leisha's bags, slinging them atop his lean Angerian courser, as Leisha turned to Bruna one last time.
"I'm too old for goodbyes that last half the day," Bruna said. "Take care of yourself, girl."
The old woman pressed a pouch into her hands, and Leisha heard the clink of Milne's coin, worth a fortune in Angiers. Bruna turned and went inside before Leisha could protest. She pocketed the pouch quickly. The sight of metal coin this far from Milne could tempt any man, even a messenger. They walked on opposite sides of the horse down the path to town, where the main road led on to Angiers. Leisha called to her father as they passed his house, but there was no reply. Ilona saw them pass and went inside, slamming the door behind her. Leisha hung her head. She'd been counting on seeing her father one last time. She thought of all the villagers she saw every day, and how she hadn't had time to part with them all properly. The letters she'd left with Bruna seemed woefully inadequate. As they reached the center of town, though, Leisha gasped. Her father was waiting there, and behind him, lining the road, was the entire town. They went to her one by one as she passed, some kissing her, and others pressing gifts into her hands. "Remember us well, and return," Ernie said. And Leisha hugged him tightly, squeezing her eyes shut to ward off tears. "The Hollowers love you," Marek remarked as they rode through the woods. Cutter's Hollow was hours behind them, and the day's shadows were growing long. Leisha sat before him on his courser's wide saddle, and the beast seemed to bear it and their baggage well. "There are times," Leisha said, "and I even believe it myself." "Why shouldn't you believe it?" Marek asked. "A beauty like the dawn who can cure all ills? I doubt any could help but love you." Leisha laughed. "A beauty like the dawn?" she asked. "Find the poor jongleur you stole that line from and tell him never to use it again." Marek laughed, his arms tightening around her. "You know," he said in her ear, "we never discussed my fee for escorting you." "I have money," Leisha said, wondering how far her coin would go in Angiers. "So do I," Marek laughed. "I'm not interested in money."
"Then what kind of price did you have in mind, Master Marek?" Leisha asked. "Is this another play for a kiss?"
Marek chuckled, his wolf eyes glinting.
"A kiss was the price to bring you a letter. Bringing you safely to Angiers will be much more expensive."
He shifted his hips behind her, and his meaning was clear.
"Always ahead of yourself," Leisha said. "You'll be lucky to get the kiss at this rate."
"We'll see," Marek said. They made camp soon after. Leisha prepared supper while Marek set the wards. When the stew was ready, she crumpled a few extra herbs into Marek's bowl before handing it to him. "Eat quick," Marek said, taking the bowl and shoveling a large spoonful into his mouth. "You'll want to get in the tent before the corlings rise. Seeing them up close can be scary." Leisha looked over at the tent Marek had pitched, barely big enough for one.
"It's small," he winked, "but we'll be able to warm each other in the chill of night."
"It's summer," she reminded him.
"Yet I still feel a cold breeze whenever you speak," Marek chuckled. "Perhaps we can find a way to melt that."
Besides, he gestured past the circle where misty forms of corallings had already begun to rise. It's not as if you can go far. He was stronger than her, and her struggles against him did as little good as her refusals. With the cries of corallings as their backdrop, she suffered his kisses and pawing at her, hands fumbling and rough. And when his manhood failed him, she comforted him with soothing words, offering remedies of herb and root that only worsened his condition. Sometimes he grew angry, and she was afraid he might strike her. Other times he wept, for what kind of man couldn't spread his seed? Leisha weathered it all, for the trial wasn't too high a price to pay for passage to Angiers. I'm saving him from himself, she thought each time she dosed his food, for what man wished to be a rapist? But the truth was, she felt little remorse. She took no pleasure in using her skills to break his weapon. But deep down there was a cold satisfaction. As if all her female ancestors throughout the untold ages since the first man who forced a woman to the ground were nodding in grim approval that she had unmanned him before he could unmaiden her. The days passed slowly, with Marek's mood shifting from sour to spoiled as each night's failure mounted upon him. The last night, he drank deep from his wineskin, and seemed ready to leap from the circle and let the demons have him. Leisha's relief was palpable when she saw the forest fortress spread out before them in the wood. She gasped at the sight of the high walls, their lacquered wards hard and strong, large enough to encompass Cutter's Hollow many times over. The streets of Angiers were covered with wood to prevent demons from rising inside. The entire city was a boardwalk. Narek took her deep into the city and set her down outside Giselle's hospit. He gripped her arm as she turned to go, squeezing hard, hurting her. What happened out beyond the walls, he said, stays out there. I won't tell anyone, Leisha said. See that you don't, Narek said. Because if you do, I'll kill you. I swear, Leisha said. Gather his word. Marek grunted and released her, pulling hard on his courser's bridle and cantering off. A smile touched the corners of Leisha's mouth as she gathered her things and headed toward the hospit. Chapter 15. Fiddle Me of Fortune. 325 AR. There was smoke and fire, and a woman screamed above the corling shrieks.
I love you.
Roger started awake, his heart racing. Dawn had broken over the high walls of Fort Angiers, soft light filtering in through the cracks in the shutters. He held his talisman tightly in his good hand as the light grew, waiting for his heart to still. The tiny doll, a child's creation of wood and string, topped with her lock of red hair, was all he had left of his mother. He didn't remember her face, lost in the smoke, or much else about that night, but he remembered her last words to him. He heard them over and over in his dreams. I love you. He rubbed the hair between the thumb and ring finger of his crippled hand. Only a jagged scar remained where his first two fingers had been, but because of her, he had lost nothing else. I love you. The talisman was Roger's secret ward, something he didn't even share with Arik, who had been like a father to him. It helped him through the long nights when darkness closed heavily around him, and the calling screams made him shake with fear. But day had come, and the light made him feel safe again. He kissed the tiny doll and returned it to the secret pocket he had sewn into the waistband of his motley pants.
Just knowing it was there made him feel brave. He was 10 years old. Rising from his straw mattress, Roger stretched and stumbled out of the tiny room, yawning. His heart fell as he saw Arik passed out at the table. His master was slumped over an empty bottle, his hand wrapped tightly around its neck, as if to choke a few last drops from it. They both had their talismans. Roger went over and pried the bottle from his master's fingers. "Who was that?" Arik demanded, half lifting his head.
"You fell asleep at the table again," Roger said.
"Oh, it's you, boy," Arik grunted. "That is that ripping landlord again."
"The rent's past due," Roger said. "We're set to play small square this morning."
"Rent," Arik grumbled. "Always the rent."
"If we don't pay today," Roger reminded, "Master Kevin promised he'd throw us out."
"So we'll perform," Arik said, rising.
He lost his balance and attempted to catch himself on the chair, but he only served to bring it down on top of him as he hit the floor. Roger went to help him up, but Arik pushed him away.
"I'm fine," he shouted, as if daring Roger to differ, as he rose unsteadily to his feet. "I could do a backflip," he said, looking behind him to see if there was room. His eyes made it clear he was regretting the boast.
"We should save that for the performance," Roger said quickly.
Arik looked back at him.
"You're probably right," he agreed, both of them relieved. "My throat's dry," Arik said. "I'll need a drink before I sing."
Roger nodded, running to fill a wooden cup from the pitcher of water.
"Not water," Arik said. "Bring me wine. I need a claw from the demon that cored me."
"We're out of wine," Roger said.
"Then run and get me some," Arik ordered.
He stumbled to his purse, tripping as he did, and just barely catching himself. Roger ran over to support him. Arik fumbled with the strings a moment, then lifted the whole purse and slammed it back down on the wood. There was no retort as the cloth struck, and Arik growled.
"Not a clat," he shouted in frustration, throwing the purse.
The act took his balance, and he turned a full circle trying to right himself before dropping to the floor with a thud. He gained his hands and knees by the time Roger got to him, but he retched, spilling wine and bile all over the floor. He made fists and convulsed, and Roger thought he would retch again. But after a moment, he realized his master was sobbing.
"It was never like this when I worked for the Duke," Arik moaned. "Money was spilling from my pockets then."
"Only because the Duke paid for your wine," Roger thought, but he was wise enough to keep it to himself. Telling Arik he drank too much was the surest way to provoke him into a rage. He cleaned his master up and supported the heavy man to his mattress. Once he was passed out on the straw, Roger got a rag to clean the floor. There would be no performance today. He wondered if Master Kevin would really put them out, and where they would go if he did. The Angerian ward wall was strong, but there were holes in the net above, and wind demons weren't unheard of. The thought of a night on the street terrified him. He looked at their meager possessions, wondering if there was something he could sell. Arik had sold Gerald's destrier and warded shield when times had turned sour, but the messenger's portable circle remained. It would fetch a fair price, but Roger wouldn't dare sell it. Arik would drink and gamble with the money, and there would be nothing left to protect them when they were finally put out in the night for real. Roger, too, missed the days when Arik worked for the Duke. Arik was loved by Rhinebeck's whores, and they had treated Roger like he was their own. Hugged against a dozen perfumed bosoms a day, he'd been given sweets and taught to help them paint and preen. He hadn't seen his master as much then. Arik had often left him in the brothel when he journeyed to the hamlets, his sweet voice delivering ducal edicts far and wide. But the Duke hadn't cared for finding a young boy curled in the bed when he stumbled into his favorite whore's chamber one night, drunk and aroused. He wanted Roger gone, and Eric with him. Roger knew it was his fault that they lived so poorly now. Eric, like his parents, had sacrificed everything to care for him. But unlike with his parents, Roger could give something back to Eric. Roger ran for all he was worth, hoping the crowd was still there. Even now, many would come to an advertised engagement of the sweet song, but they wouldn't wait forever. Over his shoulder, he carried Eric's bag of marvels. Like their clothes, the bag was made from a jongleur's motley of colored patches, faded and threadbare. The bag was filled with the instruments of a jongleur's art. Roger had mastered them all, save the colored juggling balls. His bare, calloused feet slapped the boardwalk. Roger had boots and gloves to match his motley, but he left them behind. He preferred the firm grip of his toes to the worn soles of his bell-tipped motley boots, and he hated the gloves. Eric had stuffed the fingers of the right glove with cotton to hide the ones Roger was missing. Slender thread connected the false digits to the remaining ones, making them bend as one. It was a clever bit of trickery, but Roger was ashamed each time he pulled the constrictive thing onto his crippled hand. Eric insisted he wear them, but his master couldn't hit him for something he didn't know about. A grumbling crowd milled about Small Square as Roger arrived. Perhaps a score of people, some of those children. Roger could remember a time when word that Eric's sweet song might appear drew hundreds from all ends of the city, and even the hamlets nearby. He would have been singing in the temple to the Creator then, or the Duke's amphitheater. Now, Small Square was the best the guild would give him, and he couldn't even fill that. But any money was better than none. If even a dozen left Roger a clat apiece, it might buy another night for Master Kevin. So long as the Jongleur's Guild didn't catch him performing without his master. If they did, overdue rent would be the least of their troubles. With a woot, he danced through the crowd, throwing handfuls of dyed wing seeds from the bag. The seed pods spun and fluttered in his wake, leaving a trail of bright color. "Eric's apprentice," one crowd member called. "The sweet song will be here after all." There was applause, and Roger felt his stomach lurch. He wanted to tell the truth, but Eric's first rule of jongling was never to say or do anything to break a crowd's good mood. The stage at Small Square had three tiers. The back was a wooden shell designed to amplify sound and keep inclement weather off of performers. There were wards inscribed into the wood, but they were faded and old. Roger wondered if they would grant succor to him and his master should they be put out tonight. He raced up the steps, handspringing across the stage and throwing the collection hat just in front of the crowd with a precise snap of his wrist. Roger warmed every crowd for his master, and for a few minutes he fell into that routine, cartwheeling about and telling jokes, performing magic tricks, and mumming the foibles of well-known authority figures. Laughter. Applause. Slowly the crowd began to swell. 30, 50. But more and more began to murmur, impatient for the appearance of Eric's sweet song. Roger's stomach tightened, and he touched the talisman in his secret pocket for strength. Staving off the inevitable as long as he could, he called the children forward to tell them the story of the return. He mummed the parts well, and some nodded in approval. But there was disappointment on many faces. Didn't Eric usually sing the tale? Wasn't that why they came? "Where's the sweet song?" someone called from the back. He was shushed by his neighbors, but his words hung in the air. By the time Roger had finished with the children, there were general grumbles of discontent. "I came to hear a song," the same man called. And this time others nodded in agreement. Roger knew better than to oblige. His voice had never been strong, and it cracked whenever he held a note for more than a few breaths. The crowd would turn ugly if he sang. He turned to the bag of marvels for another option, passing over the juggling balls in shame. He could catch and throw well enough with his crippled right hand, but with no index finger to put the correct spin on the ball, and only half a hand to catch with, the complex interplay between both hands when juggling was beyond him. "What kind of jongleur can't sing and can't juggle?" Eric would shout sometimes. Not much of one, Roger knew. He was better with the knives in the bag, but calling audience members up to stand by the wall while he threw required a special license from the guild. Eric always chose a buxom girl to assist, who more often than not ended up in his bed after the performance. "I don't think he's coming," he heard the same man say. Roger cursed him silently. Many of the other crowd members were slipping away as well. A few tossed clats in the hat out of pity, but if Roger didn't do something soon, they would never have enough to satisfy Master Kevin. His eyes settled on the fiddle case, and he snatched it quickly, seeing that only a few onlookers remained. He pulled out the bow, and as always, there was a rightness in the way it fit his crippled hand. His missing fingers weren't needed here. No sooner than he put bow to string, music filled the square. Some of those who were turning away stopped to listen, but Roger paid them no mind. Roger didn't remember much about his father, but he had a clear memory of Jessam clapping and laughing as Eric fiddled. When he played, Roger felt his father's love, as he did his mother's when he held his talisman. Safe in that love, he let fear fall away, and he lost himself in the vibrating caress of the strings. Usually he played only an accompaniment to Eric's singing, but this time Roger reached beyond that, letting his music fill the space sweet song would have occupied. The fingers of his good left hand were a blur on the frets, and soon the crowd began clapping a tempo for him to weave the music around. He played faster and faster as the tempo grew louder, dancing around the stage in time to the music. When he put his foot on one of the steps on the stage and pushed off into a backflip without missing a note, the crowd roared. The sound broke his trance, and he saw that the square was filled, with people even crowded outside to hear. It had been some time since even Eric drew such a crowd. Roger almost missed a stroke in his shock, and gritted his teeth to hold on to the music until it became his world again. "That was a good performance," a voice congratulated as Roger counted the lacquered wooden coins in the hat. Nearly 300 clats. Kevin wouldn't pester them for a month. "Thank you," Roger began, but his voice caught in his throat as he looked up. Masters Jason and Edom stood before him. "Guildsman." "Where's your master, Roger?" Edom asked sternly. He was a master actor and mummer whose plays were said to draw audience members from as far as Fort Risen. Roger swallowed hard, his face flushing hot. He looked down, hoping that they would take his fear and guilt as shame. I don't know, he said. He was supposed to be here. Drunk again, I'll wager, Jason snorted. Also known as Golden Tone, a name he was said to have given himself, he was a singer of some note, but more importantly, he was the nephew of Jansen, Duke Rhinebeck's first minister, and made sure the entire world knew it. Old Sweet Song is pickled sour these days. It's a wonder he's kept his license this long, Edom said. I heard he soiled himself in the middle of his act last month.
That's not true, Roger said.
I'd be more worried about myself if I were you, boy, Jason said, pointing a long finger in Roger's face. Do you know the penalty for collecting money for an unlicensed performance? Roger paled. Eric could lose his license over this. If the guild brought the matter to the magistrate as well, they could both find themselves chopping wood with chained ankles.
Adam laughed. "Don't worry, boy," he said. "So long as the guild has its cut." He helped himself to a large portion of the wooden coins Roger had collected. "I don't think we need to make further note of this incident." Roger knew better than to protest, as the men divided and pocketed over half the take. Little, if any, would actually find its way to the coffers of the Jongleurs Guild. "You've got talent, boy," Jason said as they turned to go. "You might want to consider a master with better prospects. Come see me if you tire of cleaning up after old Sour Song." Roger's disappointment lasted only until he shook the collection hat. Even half was more than he had ever hoped to make. He hurried back to the inn, pausing only to make a single stop. He made his way to Master Kevin, whose face was a thunderhead as the boy approached. "You'd better not be here to beg for your master, boy," he said. Roger shook his head, handing the man a purse. "My master says there's enough there for a 10-day, he said. Kevin's surprise was evident as he hefted the bag and heard the satisfying clack of wooden coins within. He hesitated a moment, then grunted and pocketed the purse with a shrug. Eric was still asleep when he returned. Roger knew his master would never realize the innkeep had been paid. He would avoid the man assiduously and congratulate himself on making it 10 days without paying. He left the few remaining coins in Eric's purse. He would tell his master he had found them loose in the bag of marvels. It was rare for that to happen since money became tight, but Eric wouldn't question his fortune once he saw what else Roger had brought. Roger placed the wine bottle by Eric's side as he slept. Eric was up before Roger the next morning, checking his makeup in a cracked hand mirror. He wasn't a young man, but neither was he so old that the tools in a jongleur's paint box couldn't make him look so. His long, sun-bleached hair was still more gold than gray, and his brown beard, darkened with dye, concealed the growing wattle beneath his chin. The paint matched his tan skin so closely that the wrinkles around his blue eyes were all but invisible. "We got lucky last night, my boy," he said, contorting his face to see how the paint held. "But we can't avoid Kevin forever. That hairy badger will catch us sooner or later, and when he does, I'd like more than..." He reached into the purse, pulling out the coins and flicking the lot into the air. 6 clats to our name. His hands moved too fast to follow, snatching the coins out of the air and putting them into a comfortable rhythm in the air above him. "Have you been at your juggling, boy?" he asked. Before Roger could open his mouth to reply, Eric flicked one of the clats his way. Roger was wise to the ruse, but ready or not, he felt a stab of fear as he caught the coin in his left hand and tossed it up into the air. More coins followed in rapid succession, and he fought for control as he caught them with his crippled hand and tossed them to the other to be put into the air again. By the time he had 4 coins going, he was terrified. When Eric added a 5th, Roger had to dance wildly to keep them all moving. Eric thought better of tossing the 6th and waited patiently instead. Sure enough, Roger fell to the floor in a clatter of coins a moment later. Roger cringed in anticipation of his master's tirade, but Eric only sighed deeply. "Put your gloves on," he said. "We need to go out and fill our purse." The sigh cut even deeper than a shout and a cuff on the ear. Anger meant Eric expected better. A sigh meant his master had given up. "No," he said. The word slipped out before he could stop it, but once it hung there in the air between them, Roger felt the rightness of it, like the fit of the bow in his crippled hand. Eric blustered through his mustache, shocked at the boy's audacity. "The gloves, I mean," Roger clarified, and saw Eric's expression change from anger to curiosity. "I don't want to wear them anymore. I hate them." Eric sighed and uncorked his new bottle of wine, pouring a cup.
"Didn't we agree," he said, pointing at Roger with the bottle, "that people would be less likely